You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, as UK Prime Minister Theresa May heads to Germany to talk about all things Brexit, we'll ask what style of leadership from the UK the Germans can now expect.
I've been clear that Brexit means Brexit and the United Kingdom is going to make a success of it. But I also want to be clear here today and across Europe in the weeks ahead that we are not walking away from our European friends.
My guests, John Everard and Sebastian Burger, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest events in Turkey following Friday's failed military coup. And we'll also be looking at the US presidential race and asking, who on earth is Libertarian hopeful Gary Johnson?
Libertarians are fiscally responsible and socially liberal. If you look up the definition of a classic liberal, if you Wikipedia classic liberal, I'm a classic liberal.
All that, plus we will assess Brazilian footballing legend Pelé's goal to become a musician in time for the Olympics. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Burger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and John Everard, the former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. Now, the UK Prime Minister Theresa May is in Berlin today. She's meeting German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and there's lots to discuss, ranging from Brexit to European security concerns in the wake of the attacks in Nice and also on a passenger train in Germany in the past week. Well, a little earlier, May and Merkel took to the podiums in Germany. Let's hear a little of what they had to say.
I've been clear that Brexit means Brexit, and the United Kingdom is going to make a success of it. But I also want to be clear, here today and across Europe in the weeks ahead, that we are not walking away from our European friends. Britain will remain an outward-looking country and Germany will remain a vital partner and a special friend for us. We have centuries of shared history, our languages and culture are deeply intertwined, and in recent decades we've developed a strong alliance. And it's in that constructive spirit that I've come here today to lay the foundations for a strong relationship in the months and years ahead. I want Britain to continue to work with our European partners to boost trade and economic growth and to tackle the shared challenges we face.
Sebastian, you get the sense that both Theresa May and definitely Angela Merkel are politicians who cut to the chase. They don't like to kind of waffle. They don't want to kind of make things nice for each other. They'll tell it straight and probably have a bit of respect for each other. Do you think that actually, although they have a disagreement over Brexit, they may have had a reasonable meeting?
Interesting that you say they don't waffle. Angela Merkel in Germany has a reputation of waffling along for months on end without taking a decision, apart from the refugee crisis, of course. So I'm not so sure whether that's a correct description of Merkel. I think they can get along. Yeah, I mean they are. They seem to me both very analytical minds. Merkel, of course, a physicist with a doctorate. Both brought up in Protestant, you know, in vicarages. Both childless. Both coming through fairly. Of course, Merkel was behind the Iron Curtain until the age of 35. And May was, apart from that famous speech where she talked about the image of the Conservatives as a nasty party, was, you know, an efficient, fairly smooth operator, but nobody noticed her particularly.
And before we bring in John, a sense of relief, though, whatever they make of May, that God, it wasn't some of the other candidates who could have been heading their way, who were much more kind of aggressive characters on Brexit. Sebastian.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that is one thing where you can rely on Merkel. She would have made it work with anybody. She's just that kind of politician. She's quite rightly saying, well, look, if the Brits are silly enough to send us someone like Gove or Johnson, I'll have to deal with them. And she would have done that. But sure, I mean, you know, to have a sensible, grown-up politician there like Theresa May is a plus.
John, you've been in numerous kind of diplomatic meetings. You've watched ministers in action. You know how all of this works. The show that was put on today, is it a show, or do you think that there was really this kind of sense that they have sized each other up and they get each other?
I think if they had sized each other up by that stage, they would have been remarkably quick about it. No, this was largely show. I mean, if you're stuck in front of television cameras, you make sure that you look as if you're getting on, regardless of what the realities are. That said, I think Sebastian's right. I think there's every reason to believe that these two women, who have so much in common, are going to hit it off, and that this could be a very important relationship. I ought to say that alongside all the common points that Sebastian has quite rightly enumerated, I think there's one big difference. I'd never seen Angela Merkel wearing kitten heels.
Yes, we must avoid getting too caught up in the style question, because otherwise three gentlemen sitting around discussing women politicians' clothes won't go down very well. But actually on that, John, you know, it's interesting when May went to meet Nicola Sturgeon, the first kind of meeting she went to do, there was a comment, I think, from Nicola Sturgeon, who said, you know, we are two women talking to each other. She did make a bit of a feminist agenda. Do you think it makes any iota of difference whether it's men or women speaking to each other on these issues?
Yes, of course it does. Of course it does. I don't think it necessarily affects the outcome of the meetings. But in terms of what appears on your television screens, this is very important. I mean, girls everywhere look at two confident, powerful women trying to sort out the world's affairs, and some of them will think, I could do that.
Well, that's the bigger message. But Sebastian, do you think that actually, in the sense of the politics that gets done, you know, two women, two practical women, two hard-headed women like this will deliver anything that has to do with gender?
No, I can't believe that. I think there's, in the end, they are prisoners of their country's interests and want to obviously do the best by their respective countries, and they will presumably both also have the partner's interests in mind, and so they will come to a good agreement, whether male or female. It's about the tone. It's not about the outcome at all, I don't think.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have to remember that one of Theresa May's declared objectives in this meeting is to form a bond with Angela Merkel. I mean, she's worked out that alongside the formal negotiation, which is only allowed to start once the UK triggers the famous Article 50, she is going to need to have close relations.
It wasn't very difficult to work out, was it?
Well, no, there was a lot of talk, remember, of informal negotiations before Article 50 was triggered.
Well, that was from the British side, before they kind of actually read the rule book and they understood what was really allowed. You know, well, there's no sense that any of the kind of European partners are up for kind of like handing over all the cake before anything's done.
No, it's not in the rule book. The Article 50 is actually very brief and doesn't say whether you can have a negotiation before as well as after. That idea collapsed, of course, when Juncker skewered it. So that's not going to happen. So instead of that, the very least you can do is to have strong relations with the main leaders in Europe. The weakness with this approach is that Article 50, when it's finally triggered and the process that it starts, has to go forward by complete consensus. It needs only one European leader to play difficult, and the whole thing falls apart.
I tell you what I think is a problem with her approach. She is very much doing what the Brits have always done, namely big power politics. So you go to Berlin, obviously, and then you go to Paris, obviously. You do not go to Brussels, and that's a mistake as far as I'm concerned. She should go to Brussels. She should speak with the people there, who in fact in the person of, I mean, Juncker, okay, problem, but Donald Tusk is actually very much on Britain's side. I mean, he was the one who said, we, the European Union, the Remainers, so to speak, have to have a very close look at ourselves and analyze what this vote in Britain tells us. So a great grave mistake as far as I'm concerned. Also the extremely arrogant, stupid statement saying, I have decided to forego the British presidency of the EU next year. Laughable. Nobody would have allowed the Brits to have anything to do with the EU presidency in the second half of 2017. Absolutely laughable. The tone is not right. right. The Brits need more humility.
Just tell me, let's be honest, the three of us, I think, were bordering on useless guessing where this would go prior to the vote. And, you know, anybody listening to or who knows anything about Monocle knows that we still stand on the belief that it's a poor decision and a decision that is going to have consequences for culturally for the UK, economically for the UK, which are going to be borderline disastrous. But Sebastian, when you look, at least in the sense you get from May going to see Merkel, is it's not being done in a hot-headed way, and there is some room for manoeuvre. You know, even today in PMQs, May was very, very kind of, you know, wishy-washy on the numbers for migration, for example. You know, she says Brexit is Brexit, and we'll still see what that means. You know, she certainly has to carry the party in a lot of angry Brexiteers at the moment. But even now, when you look at the roadmap ahead, do you have any sense of what Brexit might look like?
Well, no, because nobody has any sense. I mean, I've heard from Germans who work for the British government, who are being asked by the Brexit ministry, you know, what they should do. I mean, it really is astonishing that the fifth largest industrial nation of this world goes into a vote like that and has absolutely no clue what to do in case that the people take one of two options. I mean, it is staggering, and you quite rightly say, well, of course, the new prime minister, and she looks competent and she is calm and cool, and that's great, but they need to come up with a plan fast, and they need to do it. It's not Berlin's or Brussels or Paris's responsibility. This is Britain's responsibility.
Well, during the press conference, Merkel did make that clear during the press conference. She said, you know, it's up to Great Britain. We don't know what you want. You tell us what you want. You get to a position, but we will give you time to do that. And that is different from some of the other European leaders who, especially in the heat of the post-vote, were saying, OK, you've got 2 or 3 days to kind of, you know, start this withdrawal from the EU, because otherwise you're going to pull down the whole house.
Yes, I think a lot of silly things were said straight after the referendum. There was a lot of emotion, there was a lot of heat around. Article 50 is quite clear. It is the leaving state that decides when to trigger. There are questions of common decency and political respect for your former partners. You don't want to drag out too long. But the timetable that Theresa May has sketched out, so Article 50 right at the end of this year, possibly right at the beginning of 2017, seems to be acceptable to most people. And coming back to Sebastian's point,
well, yes, of course, so, you know, acceptable to most people who want to leave, but certainly not to 16 million Brits who want to remain. There's many other people who feel that, you know, the whole, they still are not invested in this process. And that is the interesting thing for the Tory party. At the moment, they're carrying, you know, kind of the buzz of, you know, of the win, and they're carrying the buzz of the support from lots of the right-wing papers. But what's interesting to watch is what happens over the months, because that is 16 million people already we know did not want this to happen, like 1% away from having a majority, 1.2%. And actually, as those figures waver over the coming months, it's going to be increasingly difficult to pull people along the path. And, you know, I will get to a question, but Sebastian, the interesting thing is, you know, you say it's not fair on Germany. It's not fair on British people. 16 million British people are working for companies and businesses where they have no damn idea what the plan is for the next 2 years. Do you invest in your company? Do you expand overseas? Do you pitch for the European contract? Will you be able to bring staff between your offices? You haven't got an idea. So, you know, while that, you know, I agree, I've presented this as a moment of calm, John, it's kind of disastrous, isn't it? Because unless she moves a little bit quicker, even for the British people, you will see investment leak away, people that will leave, and, you know, there will be a talent drain here that you can already feel it in the city with people's decisions.
Yes, there's going to be a difficult 6 months. No, she should not move any faster. To move too fast would be hugely damaging. She needs to go and talk to people. But I think there's some truth in what you say. I think that there'll be a lot of pain over the next 6 months as people see the economic effects of Brexit. A lot of people who voted for Brexit are going to perhaps have second thoughts. And it may be that when the time comes to actually press the button, the world will look a very different place. Let's see.
Well, we're going to move on now to another thorny issue, Turkey. The ongoing purge by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in reaction to Friday's failed military coup has now seen teachers, journalists, police, judges and military personnel detained or suspended. The numbers are staggering. 50,000 people are now said to be implicated in the coup by authorities. And the latest twist comes from Turkey's Higher Education Council, which has now banned academics from leaving the country. You know, John, if this started off as an attempt to catch coup leaders, it has turned out to be an old-fashioned Stalinist-style purge, hasn't it?
It's looking very much that way, isn't it? I mean, the rationale offered for this grounding of academics, that a lot of universities had ties with the coup leaders and were in contact with the military, is just a little bit thin. I mean, you do not, on that basis, sack virtually all the deans of your universities. You do not purge 21,000 teachers. This is going way over the top. Also very clear that the lists that AK are using to conduct these purges must have been compiled with considerable effort long before the coup. They were sitting waiting for this kind of opportunity. They must be rubbing their hands with glee.
I wonder if that was the 1% of the vote that David Cameron needed. If we'd had the coup two or three weeks ago, pre-vote, and then it would have been clear that there was no way that Turkey is ever going to be an EU member in a million years, maybe that would have solved our first question tonight. But when you listen, Sebastian, to what's happening in Turkey, you know, it's a country where actually Germany does have quite a lot of influence, you know, through the traditions of the Gastarbeiter and now many Turks who have become Germans. Do you think that this is somewhere where Merkel has any influence, or where the Germans have any influence?
And we were allies in the First World War, don't forget that. Look, it's interesting because we in Germany today think of the 20th July 1944, when parts of the German army and the remaining political elites tried to kill Hitler and take over the state before it and end the war in that sense, and of course didn't succeed. The purge afterwards was I mean, I'm not comparing the two, Hitler and Erdogan, but the purge was far beyond any of the putsch leaders, and Erdogan, in my view, is I mean, if it wasn't pre-planned, then they are extremely efficient in the way they now get rid of all and everyone who is even remotely only under the suspicion of having anything against his regime. It's very frightening, very frightening. And I think, I mean, from Angela Merkel's point of view, of course, it's extremely awkward with this rather unpleasant refugee deal that was cut about 2-3 months ago, and we are all now looking nervously, of course, if he really reinstates the death penalty, that's it for the EU membership, and then we'll see Turkey, I think, slide into the abyss of the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, etc. Very, very, very bleak.
Yes, very, very bleak. I agree with all of that. I not only is it an end to Turkey's aspirations to join the EU, but of course Turkey's membership of NATO is now also being called into question. Purges on this scale are deplorable in any case. They are all the more deplorable when they're being conducted by a man who has quite clearly convinced himself that the coup was mounted by Gulen, although he hasn't produced a shred of evidence for this. And one wonders what actual grounds there are for anybody to be included on those lists. Is it as flimsy as the evidence, quote-unquote, that he thinks supports the idea that Gulen was behind the coup? Can I just come back, Andrew? I mean, you suggest that something as grand and important as a coup in Turkey might have affected the referendum result. If only the British electorate were so switched on. What really shifted the referendum was the weather. It rained on 23rd of June. That's why we left.
I think loads of things shifted, but you know, the preposterous idea that every Turk wanted to come and live in London, and actually, you know, if you meet most kind of educated Turks, we'd be rather lucky. But anyway, that's a different subject. We're going to have rather jollier topics, I promise you, after this.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Sebastian Borger and John Everard. Donald Trump is now officially the Republican nominee for the US election. The billionaire's success was confirmed last night at the Republican Party's convention. It's a landmark moment in the presidential race, putting Trump on a collision course with the Democrat nominee Hillary Clinton. That's a stark choice for Americans, but it's not the only one available. Certain polls have recently shown that former Republican governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, is proving oddly popular with voters. He's running as a Libertarian candidate, and should he reach a polling rate of 15% approval, a 3% rise from his current standing at 12%, he may be a viable run for the presidency. Though Johnson has little chance, actually, of winning, a third party might potentially benefit the polarised nature of US politics. Well, let's hear what being a libertarian actually means to someone like Gary Johnson.
Libertarians are fiscally responsible and socially liberal. If you look up the definition of a classic liberal, if you Wikipedia a classic liberal, I'm a classic liberal. And I think most people fall in that category. Right now, there's a website, isidewith.com. Mm-hmm. In 2012, that was also online, isidewith. And most of the people that took that test aligned with me. And so most people in this country are actually classical liberals. I think they are libertarian. They just don't know it.
Sebastian, an American politician who doesn't shout, who sounds quite logical, he doesn't stand a chance, does he?
First of all, I'm slightly confused because I thought liberal in the American context more or less means communist. I wonder whether it's a good idea for him to call himself a classical liberal.
Well, I think second, a libertarian. I think it's got it, this slightly.
But he talked
meaning.
About liberal. No. I understand. Anyway, what he didn't say about the, 2012, his website, that was fun. But of course, he didn't say that he did stand then and got less than 1%. So, yeah, always great fun. And of course, remembering 92 with Ross Perot, that was very influential to have a third party candidate there in the debates and being part of the discussion. I wonder whether this is more than a flash in the pan, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm sure it is a flash in the pan, but you know, is interesting, Joel, when you look at most nations, how their political scenes run. They kind of feel unchanging. There's kind of, you know, there'll be a few years where there's, you know, a new party or a new person comes along and shakes up. Here in the UK, you know, we have a traditional two-party system. It's a one-party system at the moment, and a bunch of rather not very together people on the other side. When you look at Germany, you've always, yeah, it's post-war, you've always had this lineup of similar parties. It's strange how in the US, you know, going about, you know, all these years, you know, centuries, and it's still kind of a two-horse race.
Well, yes, it's a two-horse race. We still do have single-issue parties. I mean, UKIP, is diversified, but essentially it was a single-issue party. And by tradition, as a philosopher once said, single-issue parties are like bees. They sting once and then they die. And Ross Perot did that to great effect. I mean, he forced the major parties to take on board the big question of the fiscal deficit, which has now become mainstream American politics. Important to remember that before Ross Perot, it wasn't. He achieved that. And similarly, UKIP has forced immigration to the top of the political agenda. Whether it will die now, well, let's all hope.
Greens in Germany,
similar, although they're still around, but they force the environment onto the agenda, yes.
Right, and when these things are grafted onto mainstream political parties' agendas, the fringe parties that brought them there tend to just disappear quietly. Now, is the same going to happen to Gary Johnson? He's a bit different. Firstly, he's up against two major candidates, both of whom turn off a lot of people, whereas he personally is very engaging. I mean, if you watch videos of the guy, it's hard not to like him. You can disagree or agree with his political opinions, but as a human being, he comes across very warmly. And if he does achieve the 15% that gets him the right to stand alongside Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in the television debates, then strange things may start to happen.
I find also very interesting, of course, he is a former Republican governor. So is his vice presidential candidate, former governor of Massachusetts. That tells us something about that there is a Republican Party still not at the fringes of reason, but very much within reason.
Well, we're kind of used to Republicans crossing the floor, but we're going to cross a nation or two now, because we're going to head to Brazil, where, well, we're going to hear this first, and I'll explain all.
As nações do mundo prontas pra celebrar amor e muita paz, unidos somos mais, e é um novo que a gente avista. É o povo brasileiro nessa conquista. Criança pra gente, nunca desista. Nunca desista. Nunca desista.
Well, you were listening to Esperança, which is a new song by the Brazilian football legend Pelé, and the title means hope. The 75-year-old has written the tune himself. Well, he says so. And it's the unofficial song to celebrate the Rio Olympics, taking place in a couple of weeks' time. But with the country in political turmoil, its economy tanking, and the Zika virus threatening to overshadow the greatest sporting occasion on earth, that's what it says on the posters, some have taken Pelé's musical ambition to make the world happy with joy and emotion as being a little bit out of touch. John, you were swaying there. You quite like it, or do you think he's a bit daft?
It's not daft to write songs. Why should it be? Did I like it? It's mainstream bossa nova. As one of the articles that we were reading up before the programme said, the lyrics sound as if they're generated by a 1970s computer trying to link into all Olympic themes. True, but then all bossa nova lyrics are like that. As an example of its genre, it's actually not bad at all.
Sebastian, yeah.
Cringeworthy. I had to cast my mind back to Beckenbauer doing something similar in the late 70s, and I have to say, these guys' poetry was on the football pitch, and don't we all remember Pelé's 1970 World Cup, the pictures from the final against Italy? But no, he should, I think, remain silent.
There have been other horrors. Do you remember, well, why should you, the 1966 England World Cup squad singing Christmas carols, now mercifully buried in history?
I'm glad I don't.
Well, he's also, if he's being accused of being out of touch with reality, he had some good news recently. He just got married to a woman 25 years younger than him, his third marriage. So he's still doing okay. But especially on the point of whether these songs should reflect the grim realities of, you know, the machinations of Brazilian politics, we can't really land that one on him, can we?
Well, that's silly. That's silly. Obviously, you want...
It's quite hard to find a word that rhymes with riot, isn't it?
Yeah, you want feel-good songs. I mean, that's really... that's a bit naff to criticise him in that sense.
No, you cannot have bossa nova that works in a song about the Olympics with the Zika virus and the clash of the presidency. That doesn't work.
Well, you could do, but I don't think it'd be much of a hit. We haven't got much time left. But John, do you think the Rio Olympics might oddly be a bit like the World Cup and actually come off rather well?
In Brazil, these things are entirely possible. This is a country of small miracles. Keep your fingers crossed.
Sebastian, you're going to be watching the Olympics. Are you a keen fan of Team Brazil?
I'm a great fan of the Olympics and of Brazil, but I have to say, if they don't exclude the Russians, I will boycott it.
There, you've heard it. So who's going to turn up to the Olympics? Maybe Sebastian Burger is going to be leaving his running shoes at home. He's not going to be competing for Germany. You heard it here first. I think they're safe on the triple jump. Well, thank you very much, Sebastian Burger and John Everard, for... Well, we left you in a bit of a cheerier note at the end, but that's all we have for on today's Midori House. And today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, a Brazilian. I think he may have been responsible, actually, for that Pelé story. And also by Jimena Minan. And our studio manager, well, that was, of course, Christopher Grimes. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's going to be the Entrepreneur Show with Danny Giacopelli. And we're going to have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily tonight at 2200 hours London time. But don't forget, Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But if you want to get more news from us, you could also sign up to the Monocle Minute. It's a free bulletin that will pop into your email every morning. Just go to monocle.com and you'll be able to find out how to sign up. And don't forget, Thursday is a thing to look forward to. It's The Urbanist, presented by me in the evening. So lots coming up here on Monocle 24. But from me, Andrew Tuck, for now, it's goodbye.